I'd like to announce that the library carols to the number of 180 will be ready for you on the return from Christmas vacation. We have at least what sounds like a firm promise that they will all be installed by that time. That will relieve at least one seating problem. On 8 o'clock, Friday evening, November 23rd, in the tub, I invite any students remaining on campus to a very informal party that night, and trust that as many of you as can will be there. There are three events that I'm going to miss. For the first time in history, I shall miss the Oberlin game tomorrow afternoon. Worcester has now beaten Oberlin 12 successive years. We ought to relax, but this is not the season in which we ought to do that, in my judgment. Actually, I feel we've had a very fine football team this year, scores notwithstanding in the early part of the season. It seems to me only pure poetry that they should do something tomorrow. The faculty dance I take a very dim view of, but I hope you will all come to. This I shall miss. I think it ought to be called the Wishful Thinking Ball. And I wonder at what will happen. I was invited to participate in the intermission and to give a train flea act, which was one of my contributions to higher education here 3 or 4 years ago. Contrary to rumor, the fleas are still alive, but I have to be away. But do come to that. They need your help financially, if no other way. We have the only faculty club in America, as far as I know, that is in the black, but with what effort? I shall also miss most, but not all, of the counter-challenge conferences because of a board meeting scheduled for this afternoon and all day tomorrow. This morning, I want to talk on what I would call, if I gave it a name, prelude to the counter-challenge. In the first place, I want to give credit on behalf of all of us, I believe, to the people who have done, in my mind, a distinguished thing. This is the kind of thing that is the answer to the common criticism of American higher education, that it is a form of prolonged adolescence. This is not prolonged adolescence. This is the real thing. It began last year, you remember, with the efforts of the Student Senate of last year. It has been picked up and continued this year, many of the same, but the same people holding over to some degree. I heard Mr. Cardier for 2 days up in Wisconsin a couple of years ago when he came to address a 2-day meeting on the United Nations, and I can certainly vouch for him. It's a distinguished array of speakers and one of the fine things that I think people have done around here. Let's begin with this question. What question will history ask of every single person now living, almost whatever his age? It will not be just this question. You were the first age that could exterminate itself, and what did you do about it? That's a question, but it's not the main question. The main question that history will ask of you and me, and this is the thing that should haunt our dreams, is this question. You were the first age in history that could save itself and had the scientific and technical means to do so. You're the first age, quite literally, in history. This is a matter of the last dozen years that could feed, clothe, and give a reasonably decent life to all men. And what did you do about it? I take it that there's somewhere between 3 and 3.5 billion people in the earth. It's your guess as well as mine as to how many of them do not have a decent life. My hunch would be that not a billion do. And this is the problem. This is what we have to live with, and this is what we will be judged by. And there are two paralyzing beliefs now current that seem to me so full of danger that we should be aware of them daily. First is the new reliance on force. America has been a strange country, a very volatile country, with its tough and tender cycle. We either become very sentimental about peace, or we put all our faith in armament, and our very national budget reflects the extreme of our position. I have a little book here that, in the last month, just think of how you felt 3 weeks ago. How quickly you got over it. And you got over it partly on the ground that we have now the key to the problem. If we'll just be tough, everything else will give. Now, I have a certain amount of faith in that. Please understand, I do not have complete faith in it. The book that I want to recommend to you with a full heart, you won't like part of it, I don't like part of it, but it's the kind of book that jacks you up hard if you fall into the trap I'm talking about, is a book by Eric Fromm, the distinguished psychologist, called May Man Prevail, published by Doubleday and their Anchor Books at 95 cents. I'm going to ask Mrs. Holden if she will not stock them. This was first recommended to me by Professor R.J. Stevenson of our own faculty, and I have read it with consternation and delight. Mr. Fromm's main thesis is that most of what passes for political thinking in the world is simply pathological thinking that gets the dignity of being called political thinking. And this analysis is deadly and devastating. The second thing that hangs over us, oh, it hangs over you. It hangs over you so much that your daily lives are affected by it, is the acceptance of the idea that the current stalemate in the world, the Cold War, whatever you want to call it, must go on for many years. Certainly during all of your own lifetime, and that it will color and dominate practically everything you do. This seems to me the greatest atheism of our time. This will not happen if people are as bright as they ought to be. And there is such a thing as facile pessimism as well as facile optimism. There's a certain realism in this, of course. I want to read you a brief paragraph from a distinguished anthropologist, Ralph Linton, in a book, another book I can recommend to you. It was published in 1945, called The Science of Man. Now, this was right at the end of World War II. Satisfactory international collaboration is by definition a difficult and delicate task. This is not a matter which can be determined in a single conference, nor in a constitutional charter, however skillfully contrived. It will depend upon patient and far-sighted statesmanship, which will build gradually and surely toward a distant goal. The stakes are great. The millennium, however, is not at hand. Well, sure. That's the horse sense of any situation that involves more than one person. But do you believe with me that there are great breakthroughs in history? I used to sit and discuss with the Princeton history faculty one of the most interesting of all questions. I recommend it to you for discussion here. The argument was this: are the great advances that we make in history the result of institutional action and interaction that finally emerge as concepts and ideas? Or are they largely the concept that men give to circumstance, and they get these concepts and enforce them on circumstance with prodigious result? It's a nice question. I would be quite content to let that be the final and single question on an IS comprehensive for the senior year. Whatever you may believe about that, you must know that there are breakthroughs in history. And I want to tell you this morning of one breakthrough that I think is personally in our power. And if you feel I have on my Buster Brown suit, you're welcome to think so. If one out of three people in the world has something, and the other two people do not have it, you would never let that situation prevail within the confines of this room. You would never let that happen to the people sitting alongside of you here. If one of you had and the other two didn't have, and even if they were peaceful about it, you would still not let that happen. Then the ridiculous question becomes, why, if this be so, if this is the way men are made, when do they stop being men? And why? Well, the why is easy to supply. Any cynic can do that. But it seems to me, if there is to be a breakthrough, a real breakthrough in our international problem, it'll come about because people have been scrupulously and responsibly aware of the fact that now, for the first time, you could not do this in 1945. Now, for the first time, it is possible to feed and clothe and give a good life to the other two people. Well, you can hear the voices at once. They'll say, well, what if you did? What good would come of it? Here are a billion people who've tasted freedom for the first time in the world, and they're living in all kinds of different cultures, different conditions, difficult to deal with. One, the Malthusian view of this is, if you send food, and I'm not just recommending sending food, if you send food to them and feed them, or even if you go out and lead them into a new kind of agriculture, they have so many local customs and primitive conditions that it'll simply be more people and population will exceed production and the old cycle will start in again. And who says that there's nothing realistic in this concerning the matter of birth control, for example? You can think of all the arguments in the world why this won't work. That's the easiest task in the world. The hard thing is to think of how you can make it work. And this is the challenge. What I visualize is a time when we will not be selling war bonds, but we will be selling peace bonds. And they will cost us plenty of money and plenty of sacrifice. And you and I will have to do without some things. And colleges like this may have to do without some things, and all other institutions may have to do without some things until we have proved to mankind that we really mean it. And if you call the roll on this among the have nations, and the strategic situation is that the two great nations that are at sword's points today are both among, technically, the have nations. We conspicuously so. You can really call the roll. And people have to stand up and be counted. What invitation has ever been given, except among scientists, who are the civilized people of the world in these matters, what invitation has ever been given, and occasionally a pianist, and occasionally an orchestra? You read the account, didn't you, the other night of Robert Shaw's wonderful reception, the best since Van Cliburn, when he went to Russia, and what did Shaw do? He sang the Schubert Mass, and every piece he sang was a piece with religious connotation, and the Russians went wild. He got the greatest ovation of anybody since the time Van Cliburn won the Tchaikovsky competition. When have we ever said to the nations of the world, let's all sacrifice more than we would in war till we get a certain job done and do it together? That's the way to freeze and smoke people out. This is the way to find your men of good and bad will. They become immediately apparent. even while you're inspecting or not expecting their bomb store. Anybody can say things like that are dreams. I want to give you the gist of something that Samuel Gould, now the president of the Educational Broadcasting Corporation, he used to be the president of the University of California at Santa Barbara. You want the reference to this, it's in the Saturday Review of Literature for September 15th of this year. It's an article I recommend you reading. It's the most realistic analysis, the most down-to-earth analysis of contemporary undergraduate life that I've read in a long time. And after this realistic analysis, Mr. Gould says this. He says, I wish that college students could now acquire, even on these bases, certain essential things, and he ticks them off. One, self-respect, real self-respect of body and of mind. Two, respect for others. Three, an awareness of our American heritage. Four, sensitivity to life in its many facets, and all he means by that is liberal education. The gift of laughter that will relieve the pomposity of our problems. He points out that American humor is in a bad way. American humor is now primarily waspish or cynical or peevish. And what we have lost is robust humor that sits back and really, not wit, there's a big distinction. Anybody can be witty. Very few people know how to be humorous. Because humor consists in being able to laugh steadily at yourself at all times. And this is the virtue he wishes that more of you had. People I know do pretty well at it around here. And then he comes to the final one. Chief of all, he said, I could wish for any American undergraduate a new belief in the unreasonable. Whatever task is set in the world, whatever goal is established as part of one's vision of the future, there will always be any number of people who can prove by reason and logic that what is being attempted is unobtainable. Therefore, they will never make the effort, and therefore, it will not be tried. And he uses as his analogy in this the Western Trek. The utter cynicism that daily attended the progress of the covered wagon train on their great movement to the western boundary of the United States. He said the cynicism of the covered wagon train was profound. And then he says, by all the laws of aerodynamics, the bumblebee cannot fly. The one disconcerting fact is that he does. The college student, if he must cling to anything, must cling to the unreasonable. Whether this is the matter of forming his own career, choosing his own vocation, or whether he is thinking about the fate of mankind. I want to read you a poem of Richard Wilbur called Advice to a Prophet. I don't know whether you'll get it all, just hearing it orally. I rank this among one of the great things that I know in our time. I hope you can get it. I think you can get maybe 9/10 of it orally. I can't get personally a lot of things just hearing them. I have to see the print. But you can do pretty well on this. Advice to a prophet. When you come, as you soon must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity. Spare us all words of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. Our slow, unreckoning hearts will be left behind unable to fear what is too strange. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without it? The sun mere fire, the leaves untroubled about us, a stone look on the stone's face. Speak of the world's own change, though we cannot conceive of an undreamt thing. We know to our cost how the dreamt cloud crumbles, the vines are blackened by frost, how the view alters. And we could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy, the lark avoid the reaches of our eye, and the jack pine lose its knuckle grip on the cold ledge, and every torrent burn as Xanthus once its gliding trout stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's arc, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken? Ask us, prophet, how we shall call our natures forth when that live tongue is all dispelled, that glass obscured or broken, in which we have said the rose of our love and the clean horse of our courage, in which beheld the singing locust of the soul unshelled, and all we mean or wish to mean. Ask us whether with the wordless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long-standing when the bronze annals of the oak tree close. Oh, just the last four word lines again. Ask us whether with the wordless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long standing when the bronze annals of the oak tree close. Our Father in heaven, for all thy goodness and mercy, we ask thy blessing to help us be grateful. At Thanksgiving time, our hearts go out in gratitude to thee. Help us to show that gratitude by working in our separate ways, simply and humbly doing the task at hand, and give us what vision of a further task we may be capable of seeing. We ask especially thy blessing upon one of our number who has lost his mother. Give him and his family thy consoling care, courage to their hearts, gratitude for life. Give to all men this day, even those who believe they are our enemies, the sense of thy presence, the sense of what man can be if he wills, and thy will supports him. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.